Welcome to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio, bringing you insights and strategies to help you create a magnificent and fulfilling second half of life. Here's your host, certified professional retirement coach and best-selling author, Dr. Dorian Mincer.
I want to welcome all of you to my fourth Tuesday Revolutionize Your Retirement Interview with Experts series. I'm Dori Mincer, your host. So without further ado, let me introduce Raines Cohen, who is a community organizer who's pioneered in the field of aging and community. As a co-housing coach, he works to help people find and co-create sustainable communities, co-housing neighborhoods, eco-villages, and all forms of cooperative shared living that blend privacy and community. He's visited over 125 North American co-housing neighborhoods and lived in two of them, and he served as a global eco-village network ambassador. As a certified senior advisor, he loves to connect life planners and folks serving elders with new options for their clients. As a certified living in place professional, he looks for ways to help people feel safer and more secure in their existing homes as they age and evolve to incorporate new neighbors and housemates. As I mentioned, he wrote a chapter on aging and community in the book Audacious Aging, and he was a founding member of Elders Action Network and serves on the boards of Saging International and Gray Panthers of the Berkeley East Bay area. He lives with his wife, Betsy Morris, in Berkeley, California, in co-housing. I first met Raines many years ago at Positive Aging conferences, and then we see each other periodically at other conferences, and it's always been a delight to interact with him. He's truly a guru about aging in community, and I'm so delighted that he's able to be with us today. So I want to welcome you, Raines.
Thank you, Dori. It's really been great running into you over the years. I'm with Life Planning Network connections in so many different ways.
So many different ways, right? And I'm really delighted that you're able to be with us today. And I should say that Raines right at the moment is really dealing with an elderly parent, and it was on the East Coast, sort of on shift this weekend, and then has flown back to California where he lives and is temporarily in the LA area, and then will be flying back home to Berkeley later today. So I'm so thankful that you've kind of gone through a lot.
Travel agent sometimes.
Yeah, be with us today.
Make it work.
Thank you. So let's just start with, I always like to start with just, you know, what got you involved in this field to start with? I mean, what has it been, and, you know, what in your early life and career got you into this field? If we could just start with that question, that might be a good place to go.
Well, I ended up, I guess, one of those computer whiz kids in the late 70s and early 80s, getting involved in technology and, you know, learning personal computers and even working at Lotus when there were five people in a basement, summer intern. But I ended up, you know, getting involved in computer user groups, helping people support each other and learning about technology. And that's become my model. It turns out I had ended up helping start the Berkeley Mac user group, BMUG, at college when I came out to UC Berkeley, and thought I'd be getting involved in the computer field, which I've done some amount of, but it turns out those same skills of helping people take care of each other are actually relevant for real-world shared living and people taking care of each other and understanding each other and building shared ground. And so with technology journalism especially, I think, helped me in just helping people communicate well around that.
Oh, that's so interesting. So what exactly, though, the title of your chapter was Aging in Community.
Because we hear a lot of people, well, certainly we always hear the phrase aging in place, and it's, you know, the usual dream, I don't want to have to move, and especially boomers that have been helping their parents through navigate the system of support in later age and deep aging and a lot of the challenges and disabilities that come with that. They're saying, and the boomers are saying, hell no, I'm not going to go to nursing home. Let's find another way. How do we, you know, not just, you know, adapt a home? It's not just about, you know, bathroom rails or whatever, but how do we adapt a community? How do we change how do we relate to one another in ways that really support us in a deeper way? You can only go so far, and this is, I'm learning this myself after talking the theory for all this time of helping my mother through challenge, even with the support network in place. You know, she's married for 60 years. My dad's there. My sister's nearby. But, yeah, coming in from across the country and being a part of that and seeing how much work it is to maintain a system, to organize the support that's needed to help somebody in a later life. And I'm comparing that to my experience at home, where, yeah, some of my neighbors have had challenges living in community in California, and they brought in their own professional care and even hospice. But as a community, we've been able to fill so many gaps and so much of helping people with everything from rides to gardening to walking a dog to talking to their family. There's just so much more that comes out of being in relationship with your neighbors or housemates or whatever.
A lot of the things that we sometimes don't think about, but, you know, who can we count on and who's going to be there for us and who can we help? I think they're
Definitely. And that's a core part of it, because it's, you know, so many of us, we value our independence. Society tells us that, oh, you know, you have your own thing, have your privacy. That's what matters the most. You need enough money so you don't have to talk to anybody. But really, science, studies, and life experience is telling us that we need each other. People help us live better, healthier, longer lives, and being in relationship and community makes such a difference. It's not like we're here to guarantee I'm not going to come and change your diapers, but maybe there's an outside service that will, and I'm here to bring you soup, I'm here to make sure that you're still up, and we're watching out for each other in so many ways.
And I know, before I ask you another question, I just want, I'm going to alert Donna to this, that Johanna from Northampton has said that the links to the directories and other resources seem not to be working.
I tried. I made some quick changes on the website in order to make sure people could register for this. I'll go back and fix things right after the call.
Okay, so just have people know that maybe after the call, those links will be fixed.
And I'll share a couple other URLs where people can go directly, cohousing.org.
Cohousing.org, is that another one?
That's one for cohousing neighborhoods. That's one of the categories, but yeah.
Okay, and maybe toward the end, if there are other ones you want to mention. But just so people know that the links will be fixed in the Aging and Community website after the call. Okay, just wanted to clarify that. So what does it take? I mean, how do people decide that shared living is right for them rather than maybe staying, you know, and being in the home or, you know, aging in place or whatever? How do people make those decisions?
Well, it's just really important to start thinking about it, you know, before you need it. I've seen people say, okay, I'll wait till I can't move and then I'll do something. You know, I can't see, I can't drive. The longer you wait, the harder it gets, the less able you are to engage with people more as peers and make the connections and build the relationships that build the support you need. It takes a bit of looking at yourself and saying, okay, and, you know, am I a people person? And there's this stereotype of, you know, a bunch of like-minded people, let's get together, let's retire either with a family compound or college friends or wherever. But really, diversity is the strength in community, and we've learned in these different forms of community that by casting a wider net, you can really, you know, bring in lots of different people with different resources. But really, I mean, it does come down to that personal examination. It's like, okay, am I willing to live with this? We actually have a majority of introverts in at least our co-housing neighborhoods, one form of community, who, you know, you might think, oh, it's all about, I have to be a people person. But no, it's about that mix of privacy and community and adding choices into our lives. And seeing aging, and this is what goes back to our positive aging experience, it's not just about, oh, smaller world, less and less, friends are distant or they're dead. But instead it's about, oh, okay, here's ways I can design my life to have more choices and have more good options and people around.
So if somebody were to define themselves as maybe an introvert or not really social, what are ways to help somebody recognize that living in a shared community doesn't mean you're going to necessarily change your personality style, but that there, you know, that there's still privacy? I mean, how do you help people with that?
I think a lot of it is get over what our stereotypes or images from college or people who did shared living in communes or whatever in the 60s and 70s. We've learned a lot from that time. We can set the dial to the place of a mix of privacy and community. So I'm in a co-housing neighborhood. My wife Betsy and I have our own home plus our own kitchen But then we have the common house, you know, it's sort of a condo clubhouse on steroids. We you know, do our own thing, but we get together for meals a few times a week. We you know, own our home and pay our mortgage, but our part of our condo dues go to maintain the community infrastructure, and we're all chipping in a bit, finding ways to connect and make sure it's not too much work and just really have the choice. I can, you know, the physical design, the architecture makes it easy to bump into each other. The parking's more off the edge and we're seeing each other. The homes can be closer together so we don't have to yell to talk to a neighbor. It's about trying to recreate an old-fashioned neighborhood sort of design and get back to before cars move us apart and we drive into separate garages and so on. And so, yeah, that personal reflection has to come from just a serious assessment. Look at, you know, just your own life, but also just the dynamics of aging, financial, social, physical, and try to imagine a future, you know, where you have to be on your own versus, places where people can help fill some gaps and make things easier.
Yeah, that thinking ahead is sometimes a hard thing for people, of imagining when you can't drive or when, you know, it's not as easy to get around. People like to put that off.
Yeah, it's important work and it you know, engaging. I think co-housing has also been called the most expensive personal growth workshop you'll ever take because of the housing price involved. I mean, it is mostly market rate home ownership, and places like here in the Bay Area and Boston, that can be expensive, but people are innovating around that. But I've been, you know, working not just this one piece, but the whole aging community and, you know, cooperative living and the adjective sense of the world, housing co-ops, housemates. There's just so many different ways we can step up and help each other and whatever we can afford.
Which is really helpful. I mean, I'm going to intersperse a question from Joanna from Northampton, and I have a lot more to get into here with you too.
Sure.
But she, I mean, I think what you're just saying is a good segue. She says, please talk about options for people who can't afford co-housing communities and retirement communities.
Well, certainly, and we, you know, we've looked at retiring, you know, independent living and that whole spectrum of senior living, and we know that can be awfully expensive because it effectively you're paying for the, you know, somebody to build a facility with that's highly regulated and staff and profit and so on. On top of that, in our aging community movement, it's more how do we help each other, and co-housing is just one edge of it. I mean, the part that you see of homes for sale, those are just, you know, mostly the market rate home ownership, but there's rentals in community, there's housemates even inside a co-housing neighborhood. You know, if you've got this kind of shared space, a couple of my neighbors have rented out a room, and, you know, it's easy when you have the shared space, you're not in each other's faces as much. You have a little, you know, other neutral ground to get to. But also, people are innovating in housing co-ops, partnering with land trusts, even working with Habitat for Humanity, lots of ways different, even from co-housing neighborhoods where we're making more affordable, and creating options, some of which aren't always just listed on the commercial websites or on the cohousing.org national site. But we just got off a really great conference, the Affordable Conference on Affordable Cohousing, this past weekend, a virtual conference, and with a lot of great ideas, a lot of innovations that people are doing all around the country to share more and to find new ways of neighborhood organizing. In the book chapter I wrote about Beacon Hill Villages, the network where people, and I'm sure you've featured on your show, people talking about how they take care of each other, just, you know, keep living where they are in their established neighborhood. And that movement thinks of itself as a separate movement, but I really see it as an on-ramp to cooperative community. Once people get that organized and see, oh, how much are we paying for people to drive around to take care of us? And how much work is it to adapt for my existing home? Oh, we could actually invest together and make something more than the last home we need, the senior co-housing that's purpose-specific.
Right, and I think the village model is expanding around. Are you an advocate for the, like, where you live, is it intergenerational or senior? Because I know there, you know, people have different thoughts about that. I wonder if you could.
Oh, sure. We certainly hear from everybody until their 90s and beyond. I don't want to live those old people. I mean, it's a mindset. But no, our community has been intergenerational. However, I mean, so a couple of years ago, that age range was birth to 87. But half the founders are still there after a quarter century. We're 26 years old as of last week. Nobody wants to leave. It's been very low turnover. And so we've been doing a lot of the aging in community. And not bring in lots of fresh, young energy. So we're finding like, okay, let's hire more help to do landscaping rather than bend over ourselves to do it. Let's give our older members exemptions from coming and lifting the big pots and cooking, standing up a long time to cook the meals. But I very much say, no, please, we still want you at the meals. There's so many other ways people contribute and support and connect. So yeah, the co-housing developed out of Denmark as an intergenerational folks coming out of communes and shared housing saying, oh, maybe if we're having a family, can we have a little more privacy? But the big growth area has been in senior co-housing led by the boomers and creating age-specific communities. It's not, you know, institutional form, but saying, okay, sometimes, you know, with local authorities saying, okay, if you have at least one person per household over 55, we'll give you a zoning permit. You won't have to pay the school taxes or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's sometimes incentives there. But mostly it's about the philosophy of saying, okay, can I make a home that's the last one I need? Can I make sure that we've got some space that's not so noisy? You don't have to worry about tripping on toys underfoot. Just giving people more choices because co-housing has been so great for raising kids. Many communities have had a real strong energy and focus, and the parents organizing or not having to organize as many trips out because the kids can play together in community. And now it's like, oh, for seniors, can we bring the same thought process to it? Can we build that awareness and consciousness? And there's a whole study group process, successful aging.
So what's the difference? You've mentioned, you know, different arrangements. Maybe let's take a few minutes to just the difference between co-housing, co-living, home sharing, housemates, roommates. There are all these, as you say, you know, giving people more options. So can you maybe talk a little about some of the differences, some of the pros and cons of each one of them?
Well, sure, and thank you for asking, because headline writers love to mash them all up together. There's just an old piece getting circulated with a cartoon of an older woman holding a surfboard, and that an article that lumps together a lot of these things. And I'm just fascinated the way people spread memes without, you know, that don't necessarily have the deeper thought or awareness on it. So yeah, I've been talking a little bit about co-housing that I do live in and most familiar with, which is at its core condos with community, private homes with a shared area, common house, our own kitchens and meals together. And co-living is the hip young hashtag, organized especially in the form of post-college dorms and an urban area. I think of these as the new boarding houses. If you look back to the gold rush era, housing shortages, folks would just figure out how to, you know, how affordably be in a place and do a bit of sharing. But sometimes they're more corporate institutional. We saw WeWork created WeLive, and some of the big co-working companies get involved in this. So there isn't necessarily leadership from coming from the members. Participation. It's more like, oh, you're here and you're nomadic, have a place to land, a little pod. Some of them are even doing actual sleeping pods. The housing has gotten so expensive in some of these areas. But anyway, co-living, there are some that are really genuine communities, the same as you find some co-working spaces that isn't just an office space, but places where people interact and can take care of each other. And that's at its heart the piece that's most meaningful, the being part of the intentional community spectrum. And yeah, having, you know, being having an active part of choosing your housemates and sharing. And co-living, though, generally speak of as under one roof sharing. You're often sharing bathrooms or other facilities, most often one kitchen and not full separate spaces, and generally rented by the room or the bed.
And so like one person in that situation might own the house and have extra bedrooms and stuff.
Yeah, so people can make up new terms to market these things, but that's time immemorial. Somebody renting out spare rooms, college folks, you know, going in as housemates together out of economic necessity or other reasons. And yeah, the big piece of intentional communities is, what's the intention? Is the purpose just to get your shelter, or are you doing it because you want to learn from each other, you want to help each other, you can really get meaning in sharing? And this element of purpose I'd come back to later, because it's such a key part of aging as well. But you'd asked about the forms, and so there's co-ops. Well, go ahead, whichever direction you want to take it. Yeah, I thought we should just finish the list first.
No, that's good. Well, yeah. What's the difference, though, before you get into co-op, between co-living and home sharing?
So, yeah, co-living is a form of home sharing, and just think of it as a branding of it, but often it's people creating a business of it. And some people I know on the community side of it, some folks in the San Francisco area are doing some great organizing with Haight Street Commons and the Embassy Network, the Terran Collective. they're saying, okay, how can we, you know, just, you know, share space, but let's have not just meals together, but a house meeting, and let's see how do we, you know, help each other in whatever ways. I mean, home sharing, housemates, the terms, and, you know, people can physically share on whatever level. Mm-hmm. But if you have a common ground to go to about the purpose, it makes whatever small issues you're having of bumping into each other, sharing, or the dishes look small. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is the closer you're sharing, the more you're overlapping that way, the more important it is about, you know, how you select your housemates and how mm-hmm. much and how you protect yourselves and each other in the relationship.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like that underline, you said that so clearly. What's the intention that somebody has in wanting to share space, that it's important to clarify that? That's great. What about the co-ops? And you were starting to...
So there's, and especially in a number of Midwestern states and back to New York, there's a history of housing co-ops. There's even a movement of cooperatives, including worker co-ops and so on. I should note that in some cases, it's the noun sense of the word. I have to remind people it's an adjective as well. There can be a lot of uncooperative co-ops around. People often get together and, you know, it's a way to avoid, you know, condo conversion regulations or fees and say, okay, we're all own a share of this, and plus the right to live in a place. That's legally what it comes down to. Mm. But there's not necessarily shared space. There's not necessarily shared meals. But some of them really can do great things together. And it's a way that can often, and there's ways that co-op as a legal structure, because you're not getting into the real estate market as much, can provide affordability, in particular in relationship with community land trust and some other innovations in keeping the prices down, taking the price of the land out of the price of the home, and creating others. You may hear a phrase, limited equity housing co-ops or limited equity co-ops, where prices are capped. And so where my wife used to live, Betsy paid, I think, $17,000 to get in, $700 a month, pretty affordable for Berkeley to be in a small private home. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of innovations to create those.
So that lends itself to a question from Sheila from Arlington, Virginia, who says, are there blueprints or architectural drawings for housing complexes where there's a central shared core of living space? I guess, as she says, the kitchen, dining, living room, and the separate units with galley kitchens around the core?
Yeah, and you'll find sharing housing sites, possibly some models there, and in her books, some examples. And I know some folks are even working on redesigning existing homes or to better support having private wings for living and more shared space. Yeah, you can find some models out there. A lot of it really, you know, depends on the people and how much you're sharing, how much overlap you have. But the fundamental principles, and which any architect work around, is designed to have privacy, even to the point sometimes of separate entrances, but have, you know, easily shared space and the efficiencies you get of shared space. I mean, co-housing, just simply not having to have 14 different lawnmowers means we can have one really nice lawnmower and one really nice shed to put it in and invest in bikes and supporting each other and so on.
Great. Why don't you say again the book? And it's called Shared Housing.
Oh, Sharing Housing. Yeah. Anna Marie Pluhar, and there's a website of that, sharinghousing.org, that goes into some of these examples in that area.
Great. And Janet from Amherst just wonders, in terms of your own experience, does your community, engage in any specific governance process?
Yeah, most co-housing has evolved using a consensus decision-making model, and people may think that's about unanimous decisions, but really it's about, more than anything else, looking in the Quaker sense of seeking unity, trying to find the common ground, trying to take the time to hear from each other and understand one another so that we can look for ways to do things in a way that get all of our needs met, or more of them, and that don't actively interfere. It means that when we propose, oh, let's put in a tool shed, it means I talked to Jane, not a real name, who lives above where we're going to put it, and make sure she feels heard. As you know, I know she's got the nuclear deterrent power of saying, no, wait, stop, this is not, you know, this is going to create problems for me and not match our community values of taking care of each other. And so we better do our homework and do a proposal that she understands the needs for and feels heard and sees that we're adapting to her needs and setting use, you know, restrictions and things and ways to, you know, to to make sure that we're not interfering with each other's enjoyment of our lives, and we're living our separate lives, but having the ways to live better, richer lives in community. There, I mean, consensus decision making, and some groups are looking into dynamic governance, also known as sociocracy, a system that really incorporates a lot of best practices of consensus in general, and offers a good, effective delegation. And it's like, okay, not everything has to come to the whole committee. Let's really empower the finance committee to go, do the books and have clear guidelines and trust and know, make their own decisions in their own realm and come back and, give us feedback and reports. And let's, we try to have meetings that really are meaningful, not, oh no, another meeting. We meet as community 9 times a year, sometimes 10 lately, but for 3 hours. But it's always, let's have a light and lively activity. Let's have a meeting that's well designed by a facilitator. And let's make sure that we're taking a lot of check-in time to hear from each other and take care of each other. That leads to the best meetings. We're knowing where people are coming from.
So a sense of, from your experience, both where you're living as well as with these other shared models, that people need to sort of buy in ahead of time, that there are sort of the vehicles of being able to talk about these things and make these collective decisions and individual decisions.
Yeah, it's getting past a stereotype of condominiums of suing each other and preserving property values and having a non-representative board. We're all on the board, and we all have to live with the results of whatever decisions we make. So let's take the time. Sometimes that's really fast. It's like, okay, let's do this little thing. We got the money set aside. Great, go for it. Other times we were doing a kitchen remodel of our common house, and we didn't want to, impose extra special assessment fees. So we figured out, oh, there's enough reserves here, and a couple people make a donation here. And, oh, yeah, let's have a kitchen finance committee or KFC and a community design committee or ACDC and tap everybody's skills and resources and connections. Get a beautiful result.
So it does sound, well, let me ask this question, but it sounds like you're sort of speaking to it a little bit. What I'm hearing is that there is a way that a sense of purpose and shared values changes the way people relate to each other and solve problems. Sounds that way. So, talk more about that, if you would.
Well, I mean, and the community's movement sometimes when the co-housing was evolving, people said, well, that's not community. You work with developers and banks. Where's your shared value? But really, I mean, you're not sharing income. You're not wife swapping. It's like, no, it's about, the value is about being good neighbors and so much more that comes out of that. I mean, legally, being a condominium means the cities will finance and the banks will approve it, and that's what's made it a fast-growing movement, the ease of people getting into it and getting out of it. If it doesn't work for you, sell it and move on. We're not, in general in co-housing, we're not screening people coming in. It's self-selecting model, but trying to make easy open borders, as it were, and room for people to choose otherwise. That's harder when nothing else is affordable, and it's hard when it's still a small movement with a lot of choices. And I just know I personally couldn't imagine living any other way than having a 5-year-old neighbor who helps me mow the lawn, and he really does help when I use the push mower. An 85-year-old neighbor joined on some road trip to L.A. We taught her to use the GPS. She got to visit her daughter in the desert. We all got to save, and I get inspired by her activism. There's just so many ways that in relationship that we can change if we're open to it. If we're not going to say, oh, no, you can't do that, or if you start from what's possible and build on that and gain that experience in community. And that sense of, this is where in my work in AIDS, I'm now got involved with the Elders Guild and Saging International. A lot of folks have come back to Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who wrote the book From Aging to Saging. And he was founder of the Jewish Renewal Movement and a Orthodox rabbi who went to Tibet and incorporated a lot of Buddhist practice and awareness in that sort of crossover of, okay, what are old people for, as Dr. Bill Thomas's book says, right? And how can we find new purpose and meaning and things that really led me into this field of, like, a bunch of people like, ooh, I want to grow up like them. And I called myself aspiring elder, and I may be earning my way there, but way back to my 30s, I was like, okay, how can I, what's their secret? And purpose is a part of that.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. And but say more about, I mean, it's sort of a lot of these things struck you when you were younger, and I totally agree with so much of what you're saying about Reb Zalman and the saging, but, just share more, if you would, about why it's particularly important as we're getting older to think about these kind of communities.
Well, I think, you know, people at some point are saying, what's my legacy? You know, what purpose will my life have had? Where are the ripples on the pond going to go? Mm-hmm. I certainly have found that I've gone from the young activist and journalist running around and being everywhere to like, oh, where's the one place I can be? And where does this really, you know, have a meaning? And that quest for meaning, I think, is the opportunity to say, oh, well, can we be active? Can we, you know, leave a better world for those who come after us? Can I, you know, be known for something? Where's my legacy? And that's not just financial, but and the people we've affected and connected. And I go back to my computer user group work because I still, decades later, after the group's folded, people are still having dinner after the meeting. It used to be every Thursday night meetings. They were still getting together for dinner afterwards. And then people are still, you know, I'm running to people saying, wow, that changed my life. I learned about something that way. And that's, you know, the opportunity to still have at any age the chance to help a few more people, to build a greater sense of possibility, to take political action through Citizens Climate Lobby at first and now Elders Climate Action coming out of Elders Action Network. I've, you know, gone to Congress and lobbied on climate-related issues and even got inspired to help my neighbor. She was having trouble getting a reverse mortgage. The feds were rewriting the rules and saying, what's this co-housing thing? Do we have to come cook the meals? And then we, you know, thought we'd never change it. It's still a very small movement, but I met the Federal Housing Commissioner under Obama. She knew people living in co-housing and got a petition together. And I never thought I'd be wearing a lobbyist hat, but we got some rules changed and really, and now it's like, oh, my neighbor Alice really doesn't need to jump all through all these hoops so that somebody else can make some money off of her and a commercial lender. Yeah. We can crowdfund this. We can set up what we're calling the Squirrel Fund, Senior Equity and Revolving Real Estate Loans. And we can, you know, she originally was planning on a reverse mortgage as an activist on a fixed income retirement. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, oh, let's help her together take the value of her house, partner with the land trust, keep it affordable, and make sure she gets the income she needs to live well. Community.
Well, that sounds so creative and resourceful.
This is where it's just so inspiring. I just, you know,
yeah.
Neighbors at all levels and connection.
Right. I have a number of questions on from people too, but I wondered if you could just talk a little before we get into some of those other questions about what have you found in your work? What are the biggest challenges of sharing living spaces? What are the biggest benefits of it that you
discovered? The greatest joy is the people. The greatest challenge are the people. And we sometimes say consensus doesn't work on things starting with the letter P, the people issues, the personal preferences, the paint colors, progeny, puffin policy, things that we have our personal preferences. And yeah, you really do learn a lot about yourself. I think of, you know, rocks in a stream rubbing together, getting polished. I get a lot of feedback. I sometimes find in community I'm the one who's, despite being an introvert myself, I make it my job to go out and recruit and connect. And other people, oh, I just want to live here. Don't bring more people to dinner. And yeah, I've especially learned from seeing, oh wow, Jane's having trouble going through this, you know, or I'm not talking to Jane. Well, who's not talking to me? And can I talk to John, who can talk to Jane and do some of that work? There's a card deck called the Group Works card deck that we were part of creating, groupworksdeck.org. I'll include the link to it on the site, that encapsulates a lot of the learnings of people in community of like, what are the patterns that show up and how do we work well together? How do we have meetings that are actually fun and productive and community relationships that build on that? So yeah, I mean, it's still, you are together, you know, in the case of a condo, running a multi-million-dollar enterprise, maintaining old structures together. And so it's the sticks and the bricks. And we had to recently in our community come up with a special assessment of $11,000 per household to do a $250,000 seismic project. But we did it well in a way that made sure nobody was forced out, nobody was put out by that, and it was the most caring way possible. That's just such a delight. And we end up with a stronger home. We don't have to worry about trying to find a contractor after an earthquake, which would be impossible, and nobody dies. And, yeah, that's better solutions. We would come up with better solutions to problems we didn't even know about.
So So how do you handle if there's disputes between neighbors or housemates?
Gunfight, all kinds of things will come up. People are different and have different preferences and needs and connections. So one way is by creating shared space, this common space. So it's not my kitchen or your kitchen, it's our kitchen, the preventative work. We create committees that work on areas so you don't have to, you know, fight out with a person, but say, hey, this is a common house issue. Can we talk about it here in this format and then bring it to the community? Yeah, we sometimes are brought in mediation and outside help, but so much has to come from building the capacity, and we've actually trained in how do we have meaningful conversations, starting with an appreciation, starting with opening and finding, sharing about how we best learn and share and how do we like to receive input. Please don't try to tell me something as I'm running to my car. We can come up with ways of symbols to say, no, sorry, I can't. I would love to talk to you, but I can't talk to you now because we can't operate on co-housing time where it takes me 15 minutes because I run into three people and have five conversations. You know, so create time, create, you know, get to know each other, build the relationships, and that's really the secret to both preventing issues and then to resolving them, having the time. And sometimes just, you know, let time pass. Sometimes, you know, say, hey, this is not a community matter. Sometimes, okay, just a few people want to do electric cars. Let them form a club. We're not going to stop them, but they're the ones who are responsible for paying for the charger. We don't have to do everything all of everybody. This has been, I think, we can learn a little bit from corporations and rich people about, okay, let's, you know, subdivide and conquer and make it possible that we can work in whatever sphere makes sense.
And is it hard if somebody, you know, really has decided this is not for me? Is it hard to get out of it? I know you mentioned in your co-housing.
We try to design it. Well, yeah, people often don't leave, and there can be financial reasons for that. But we try to, as much as possible, make it easy, help as a community. Successful communities are out there recruiting people and doing marketing, so you have ready buyers or renters standing by and get involved. So they're not just hearing about it for the person who's leaving, but the new ones are getting connected and mentored and engaged. But it's really, it's very different community by community. I encourage people to visit, talk to different people, experience a meal or meet, and especially a meeting of a community, and get context to see how they may all make it work.
Great. So let me integrate some of the other questions here or comments. So Cohen from Hawaii, from Honolulu, is wondering if you, Rains, have heard about the Share Kananzawa in Japan.
A couple of people have been mentioning it recently. I haven't gone to investigate yet, but there's some great innovations coming out of places where, you know, already high prices and limited forms, but different ways of sharing, and both from the neighborhood scale, or there's even been Japan, some example of co-housing where one unit has a common kitchen, another has a common performance area, and the things you can do, you don't have to have it all in one separate space.
He mentions, I know he was just recently in Japan, and he says it's a new development that may be worth checking into. And he did give a website if people are interested. It's called www.thisismodernaging.com and then /amazing-japanese-retirement-home-and-senior-living-that-you-will-want-to-live-in-now. If anybody got that.
I think we get the message of it.
Right. So
I do caution people to watch out for, if you've heard of greenwashing or community washing of places, you know, the word community is a dirty word or used in condo development and, you know, other forms. So it's, you know, always look, okay, how much are the residents in charge? Are the inmates running the asylum? How much freedom is there both in getting in and getting out? You know, in co-housing, the resident participation in the design is part of what leads to better results. And also their investment is, we know, it leads to development that, you know, without the profit flowing elsewhere. There's many other aspects. So and visions, I encourage innovation in the field. I mean, we know it needs to be bigger to serve more people. Mm-hmm. But I think it's hard for people who've had, you know, a business of controlling everything and, you know, the access to the finance and so on to get to the point where it's like, oh, how do we, as people, take care of each other and how do we shift to a level that's locally run and managed?
which gets back into the intention of what you're wanting from living together, it sounds to me, which is important. So Janet from Amherst says, can you identify any sources of grants for developing a shared housing?
It's a challenging area because there's some funding available for affordable housing and senior housing and other places. But very often, there's such a great need, and the agencies involved want to make sure that goes to the neediest folks and helping people out on the streets. And often if there's federal money involved, it's like, oh, we better make sure there's a lottery so there's nobody could be benefiting individually from it. And then how do you have future participation in a project if you don't even know who's going to get into it? This whole conference was looking at different innovations in affordable co-housing this past weekend and in related fields. And there's occasionally been some grants, but it's very much jurisdiction by jurisdiction. Like Rocky Corner co-housing is just under construction. Just got to visit last month in Connecticut, and they were able to get some state funds that bring some prices down for some of the units. In Berkeley co-housing, we worked out a deal with the city where instead of paying condo conversion fees or making one unit super affordable, we got them all moderate affordable with a 30-year restriction on them. And so it takes different innovation in different ways. The best solutions I've often found come from talking to established affordable housing developers that know about the grants and their limitations and say, hey, can we help you out and make your project happen? Can we invest together? Can we work to do this in a way that makes it more inclusive and, not a ghetto, not serving just one income range? And I think that's the greatest opportunity, and pushing the limits of what's possible in the economy. Leverage what we can, but go beyond. And I've seen some affordable housing using co-housing principles that goes a long way. And we're even, I have to say, with our work with Gray Panthers, we're working with landless people, folks on the streets. Mm-hmm. There's so many in our area. And there's co-housing principles and showing up in the book Tent City Urbanism and models out of the Pacific Northwest of, if you can help people self-organize, and whether, create encampments, whether it's mobile homes or other ways of living, it's so much cheaper than trying to support people out on the street and try to keep them healthy and alive. You get the best results if you can, like in the co-housing community, let people self-manage and not try to have a city security guard or whatever, but support people and don't just, keep sweeping them off the streets, but give them the ability to get sanitation and build community and learn and grow together in that way. So,
excellent point. So let's see. Bill from Cambridge says, if one lives in a major city like Boston, is there a searchable database of shared housing options? On the flip side, he asks, are there any apps or human matchmakers to help find kindred spirits who would be more than compatible, who would help us be our best selves because we have a shared value, interest profile, or belief system that will help us age well? If not today, what kind of dream app would you like to see developed for individuals or groups seeking to form intentional communities?
Lovely question like that can only be coming from my friend Bill Wendell, who I just saw in Cambridge. Greetings.
Bill, yes, it is from him.
a real estate cafe. And yeah, it's a challenge because there's, regional differences, and there's the co-housing directory over here at cohousing.org. You'll find the IC.org for intentional communities. But there are a lot of group houses and another, what's Boston Co-op Network, use the term co-op-ish places. The landlord may not even know. They may pop up on Craigslist just when they have an opening and then go back undercover. A lot of connections are via Facebook and friends networks, but I sort of caution people about that. If folks like their privacy and will sometimes only share something with friends, you end up with more of the same, and you're not giving the opportunity to those who could really add a lot to your community. Or on Facebook, here's our group house. Here's a little bit about us. Tell us everything about yourself. And out of thousands of applications, we might call you back. And therefore, you have to fill it out about how much you love washing dishes and make whatever. To tell communities, host an open house. Let people come, see the place, and meet the people. Then you'll get a small pool of self-selected applications of more serious people and connections.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But yeah, there are groups like the Boston Co-op Network, for example, that does foster interregional organizing. In our San Francisco Bay Area, our East Bay co-housing group now has over 5,000 members. There's a real hunger for this, and that's what led us to the Big Tent approach to shared living and so on. And I should also name, so it was part of your intro for me, Eco Villages. It's, you know, co-housing, but with a greater purpose and creating green space and doing a real, permacultural people would call this stacking function. Systems thinking, ways of looking at the bigger picture and all the species that were there before and seven generations into the future. There's some great examples of that on ecovillage.org as directories of those. Yes, and I should mention that coming up in April 26th, it's Sunday this year, National Co-Housing Open House Day, and we're the cohousing.org site will have directories of events around. And in late summer, early fall, there's another similar day for communities modeled after one in Europe. There's different groups to get involved with. The more that you're connected, the more you can learn. So many of these opportunities are not formally advertised or don't go to MLS real estate listings. It's through knowing people and being in relationship and building community that so much comes out of that.
Is this tied into your shift? Because I'm aware that you've shifted from calling yourself a co-housing coach to saying you're an Eco Village ambassador.
The hat you see with the picture in it is sort of my coach's hat. But yeah, I've been to Estonia a couple of years ago for training with the Global Eco Village Network and really impressed the work that's being done to whether it's preserve a farm and help people build businesses around it and create a market for the farm. There's just so many of the synergies that come out of this big picture, thinking about the future, thinking about the environment, thinking about our relationships with our neighbors and species and so on. And I just think it's what's going to really matter in the world. And co-housing is a building block towards that, is a step on the way. And every community starts green and gets greener. And studies have found we drive less, we share more, we live more efficiently and use fewer resources the longer we're living in community over time. But we need to make that more accessible and connect it to the larger world and purpose. And so that's where the Eco Village movement is just going deeper on that.
Oh, great. Thanks. So Michelle from Boston says, my concern is for single women who have worked all their lives without a large nest egg and who don't qualify and don't want to live in subsidized housing. Many of us are single, no children, and orphans, i.e. parents not alive, with a sense of purpose. Is there a movement besides shared living space that are affordable, defined loosely, depending on what part of the country you live in, with limited financial risk? And she says, there seems to be subsidized housing that is federally funded and high-end retirement villages that are not accessible for most middle-class women. There are a few co-ops, but there seem to be a lot of risk, just like condos, when it comes to dated buildings and repairs. And she says, personally, she likes her own space, and also she's interested in Bill Thomas's Minka homes. Can you respond to that question?
A lot of good pieces there. And I've been at conferences with Dr. Thomas and excited about this concept of Minka homes, of backyard accessory dwelling units and ways that you can design for aging and create things more affordable. I will say that it's still a dream and a concept. I've not seen any of those actually built yet. The questioner speaks to what we call the missing middle. We create programs to help the neediest, and those who have enough money can buy their privacy or get their needs met that way. But there's a real opportunity to create more places of sharing and support. What Sarah Zef-Geber, who you probably had on, called Solo Agers, in her book, and which is, you know, women do live longer. They're more likely to have, you know, fewer economic resources or have spent the resources on caregiving. And so we're seeing people step up, both in organizing housemates and to hold this women living in community networks out of North Carolina and Florida. And I think the more that we can find ways to meet and learn together and overcome some of the obstacles and fears that are keeping us apart will lead to people feeling like, okay, I could do housemates this way. Let's set up a contract. Let's have, you know, an outside service do vetting. Let's find ways to to do more sharing, to create more space between us, and create more options. That's really what I think we're needing more of now.
Right. Important. So Bill from Cambridge question. He says, finding a site to construct a new urban co-housing community seems like a mission impossible, especially in expensive urban settings. Can you comment on any alternative approach, some call retrofit co-housing?
Yeah,
what would it take to identify a neighborhood that's ripe for a retrofit community? And is there acquisition funding to purchase and renovate some anchor houses?
It all comes down to the funding. But the short form, just next door to Cambridge, I was just at the groundbreaking 2 weeks ago of Bay State Commons in Malden, who has a community. They've been at it for not quite a decade, but quite some time of working together, having a vision, and then identifying the site and taking it through the planning approval process. And that's a lot of work, a lot of time, and a really serious investment in the community to get to the point where that can be financed to move forward. And now it'll be another year or two of construction ahead of them. So in retrofit, or also known as organic co-housing, people connect and knock down neighbors. It's sometimes called the End Street model, after one of the first communities in Davis, California. And say, if you can say, hey, if I can come use your clotheslines, would you like to come use my washer? And share resources on the neighborhood scale, and sometimes find the physical settings for that. I say it's a tricky question because there's sometimes, some of the older neighborhoods and poorer places could be some of the ideal spots that have this kind of relationship where you can connect to the yard and it's not so separated by cars and so on. But the trick to do it is in a way that doesn't displace people or create more gentrification. And there's a good model in Cincinnati of a group doing it. The name escapes me right now, but if you look up Cincinnati co-housing, you'll find folks that along a street are saying, let's organize and connect. And in some ways, parallel to the Beacon Hill Village model, how do we help people organize where they are and build relationships? And even in Oakland, California, Kingfisher co-housing bought an existing rental property, and they've been gradually fixing it up, and some of the current renters are going to buy in and participate, and they're bringing new people as well.
Great.
Los Angeles Eco Village is another good example of that.
I'm sorry, what?
Los Angeles Eco Village is another good example of that, that also incorporates the larger green purpose and neighborhood organizing.
Great. So Cindy from Natick asks, how do you expect or want people to use your website for help, guidance, and thinking through possibilities of community living?
Well, I'm hoping that people can start to, if you sign up to get the chapter, that you'll get the information. I'll share resources, and but you can choose what areas you're interested in. There's checkboxes on the forum, and share resources through work with the Elders Action Network and presenting at the Staging Conference. I've been doing a lot of, and I'll be sharing more of this on the site, network mapping of identifying these different groups that are doing the same kind of thing, but we may not even know about each other. They use some different terminology or kind of working on the problems from different ends. I presented this at the Generations United conference in Portland last year, that we really need to better understand and look at the larger picture of the network, and you'll be seeing me making more of that visible. There's a lot behind the scenes of a database of organizations, and I think to make it possible for people to start to better see how we can plug into them and how to and connect together. And I think in the same way that your show is building awareness and leading people to revolutionize retirement in their own ways, I think we can do it better together and go further, building on each other's work and not just individually reinventing.
And does it feel to you that people in the industry of aging and aging-related living businesses are learning from people like you?
There's some. It's interesting to see how things translate to commercial ventures. And it's a little scary in the Silicon Valley culture. Somebody will introduce something and throw a lot of money at it, and it could be gone tomorrow, or your data could be sold. And so I'm trying to say, okay, what lasts? What really builds? And that's person-to-person relationships, personal development, communities where people are living there, and there's real consequence that we need to make things work. We can't just fold, because we all live with results, and we all have skin in the game, investments in the project. Mm-hmm. And so that's the level I think that we can take things. We're trying to find new ways of partnering and being more effective together.
That's great. So This has just been wonderful, Rains. Just like a wealth of information. Tell again, people, what your website is, so that they have
access to it. The main website, which I'll fix up actually after my flight after the call, but agingincommunity.com. And there's others related to co-housing and the other groups I'm part of. I'm trying to put more links to those and more mapping of the network, because I can't do it alone. I really need more people out there that for themselves and for their communities and for the future are working together on these issues.
Well, this has been wonderful. So what final takeaways or thoughts? I know you've responded to so many questions, both from me, from the audience, but what final comment or takeaway would you like to have people take away with them?
Well, I appreciate so many people being on the call today, but basically, don't wait. Don't think, I hear so many people, oh, I'll talk about that later, oh, we're fine now. And you know, it takes time to get these things going. The earlier you start, the more choices you have, the more opportunity you have to build relationships, to find ways that aren't, and you would never even know about today, but together co-create and learn and do the personal work that's required to define how to live well, to age well in community and live well in community and have a better future together.
Thank you. That sounds like such an important message and hope for all of us to be able to take seriously. I hear is, you know, life is finite, and think while you're alive and well what the different options are, and that you don't have to be locked into something that maybe isn't going to work for you as you move ahead in the future. I think
choice is great and
that
empowering.
Choice, yeah. And this whole notion of intentional community, whether it be, you know, the variety of ways that you mentioned, co-housing, shared living, shared space, roommates. I guess maybe it's another parallel. It's just make me think about, you know, people talk about this stage of life being parallels in some ways with adolescence. And it's, you know, we lived often with roommates and in dorms and stuff then. And, you know, it kind of comes full circle, perhaps in a different way with a different level of perspective and wisdom and sensibility.
And hopefully the room and wisdom to say, let's not just find more people like ourselves in age or whatever other dimension, but be open to the opportunity to share and learn from somebody younger. And when the people joined our community, it went from, oh, mysterious people, I don't know if we can relate to them, to, ooh, fresh young backs. And then I'll have a couple of the youngest kids in community, and the member who passed away whose daughter has been renting out her place to a young couple and who brings in body work and electrical engineering. Perfect. I mean, it's stuff that's really useful around the community. So many ways.
Oh, that's a great example. I mean, I think intergenerational living rather than more segregated is such an important concept.
We don't lose track of the value of aging. Yes. The value of aging people. Yes.
Absolutely. No, I think let's underscore that absolutely the value of aging people, and we can learn with and from each other. But you're absolutely right. Well, thank you so much, and thank you everybody who's been on the call. It's been wonderful. I mean, I think you've just opened our eyes and thoughts to this kind of grassroots movement that's getting bigger and bigger, and that there really are options and important things to think about of being part of community and living in community. So thank you so much.
You've been listening to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio with Dr. Dorian Mintzer. To learn more about the resources mentioned on today's show, listen to past episodes, or download our free retirement transition guide, visit revolutionizeyourretirementradio.com.